Good evening and welcome everyone to our Tisha B'Av class, The Seeds of Destruction. So the genesis for the ninth day of Av begins in the Torah with source number one. The Jewish people, in response to the spies, the Meraglim's nefarious report about the land of Israel, Canaan, cried. And so in the Talmud, in Masechet Sanhedrin, it tells us the following. She weeps, yea, she weeps in the night. And the Talmud asks, why this double weeping? Why do you have two cries? So the Talmud goes on to tell us, Rabba said in Rabbi Yochanan's name, we cry once for the first temple and once for the second temple. In the night, why does it say that they cry Belilah? On account of what happened at night. For it is written, and all the congregation, these are the Jewish people in response to the report of the spies, lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. Rabba observed in Rabbi Yochanan's name, the night that the spies came back and gave the report, it was the night of the ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av. And God the Almighty said to Israel, what's going on here? You have wept without cause. Atem b'chitem b'chiyasha chinam. A baseless, warrantless cry. Okay. Va'ani ekbal lachem b'chiyah ledorot. I, God says, will establish, I'll appoint a time of real weeping where you will have justified crying for you, for future generations. And that became the ninth day of Av. So in other words, we responded with b'chia, lament, tears, weeping for no reason at all. God said, you should be joyous at this moment. We're about to enter the promised land. This is the gift. Okay. So if you're crying chinam for no reason, then I'll give you legitimate reasons for the future. So he established that anything negative, churban, destruction, would always happen in association with this ninth day of Av. So that was literally the seed of destruction. That became the moment that the ninth day of Av, and we know that it wasn't just limited to the destruction of our temples. But we know, for example, in 1492, the exile from Spain, if you read some of the dirges, the elegies that we read, the keynotes that we read on Tisha B'Av, they go through generations in Europe and such, where they burnt Torahs and there were inquisitions and pogroms and crusades. Horrific things happened. World War I started on the ninth day of Av. And generationally, really bad things have happened. So what is the source? The source is the warrantless, baseless cry and the response of God. If you cry for nothing, I'll give you a real reason to cry. Now, obviously, he didn't create the idea that these things, in other words, every one of these destructive events is not owing to that cry. It's just that this day became the day where all the events that were destined for whatever reason to happen would happen in association for that day. So it's sort of saying that on the Jewish calendar, anything bad that's going to happen, all that negativity is going to be foisted into the month of Av, where we reduce our joy, and specifically the ninth day of Av, that will be always associated with crying, lament. Okay. Now the Talmud is going to now trace the history of the ninth day of Av in association with the destruction of Temple number 2. So Temple number 1 was destroyed by the Babylonians approximately 586 before the Common Era. That's King Nebuchadnezzar and Nevuzaradan, his general. That was Solomon's temple, Shlomo HaMelech. And we know that 70 years passed. The Jewish people were in exile in Babylonia and Persia. The story of Purim happens. We triumph over Haman. We come back to Israel with Ezra and Nehemiah, Nehemiah, the prophets. We rebuild the second temple, and that lasted until its destruction in the year 70 of the Common Era, where Titus and Herod, the Romans, destroyed our temple. Okay? So that kind of gives you the chronology. So we are tonight going to explore the Talmudic, very, very famous story of tracing the destruction of Temple number 2 to a dispute between two individuals and how this is going to impact us ad hayom hazeh, until this day. So I'd like to go through the story. It's a very famous story. You've probably heard rabbis allude to the story. It's really known by the names of the individuals. Kamsa, Bar Kamsa. So there were two individuals. I'll give you a little context before we explore it in the Talmud here. I have it both in the Aramaic for your interest, and we have it, of course, in the English translation. There were two individuals, apparently, who were like the Hatfields and the McCoys to the 10th degree. One was an individual named Kamsa, and another individual was named Bar Kamsa. They were Jews. And they were both connected to a lot of powerful figures in Israel at the time of the Roman occupation of Israel. So this precedes the actual Churban, the actual destruction in the year 70. There was Roman occupation that was benign for a number of years, and then it quickly turned to not such a benign occupation, and then ultimately to destruction of our temple. There were years where the Romans actually respected the treaties that they had made with the Jewish people living in Israel, and then it just simply regressed and became a bad situation. So this is the genesis of perhaps the cause and effect of how that Second Temple was lost. So these two individuals, one named Kamsa, one named Bar Kamsa, were always at loggerheads. We don't know what the issues are. So some say it is an example of, again, we used a term, warrantless crying. So it's another type of baseless, warrantless effect, and we call it sinas chinam, baseless or warrantless hatred between Jew and Jew. And the rabbis actually, in the famous Talmud in Yoma, that deals with Yom HaKippurim, things about the Day of Atonement, says that we lost Temple 2 because of sinat chinam, because of the baseless, warrantless hatred, Jew against Jew. And of course we, I hate to say this, have never rectified this adequately. And the proof, of course, is that some 2,000 years later, Temple 3 hasn't happened yet. So clearly, the issues of Temple 2's loss have not been successfully addressed, or we would already have the third temple. Now, Temple 1, interestingly, was lost because of the capital crimes. Adultery, idolatry, and murder. The big ones. And as heinous as those crimes were, they were easy to address, right? Because there's no subtlety. It's very obvious to everyone. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not commit adultery, right? I mean, they're the big ones. They're the ones you have to give your life up for rather than transgress. So because of the clarity of sin, to repent and to return away from those and to re-inject Judaism with love and with teshuva, with repentance, was easy, right? Because it's like, that's the dark side, this is the force, I know who the dark side is, I've identified the enemy, let's repair Judaism. So it only took 70 years to repair Judaism. We know that in the story of Purim, what happened as a result of Esther and Mordechai, it says, Kimu v'kilu ha-Yehudim, they all got together, and they reinvigorated life in Persia, they reaccepted the Torah anew, each person gave matanot le'evyonim, and you know, ish re'ehu, each person to his friend gave gifts. That's where we had the beautiful custom of shalach manot, right, of sending gifts. There was a rapprochement that addressed the fundamental issues of murder, adultery. But when you're dealing with interpersonal subtleties, 2,000 years and counting, we have never been able to rectify it. So, Kamsa Bar Kamsa, let's investigate this story. So you had these two Jews, and interestingly, one of them never makes an appearance in the story. So we always associate the story as Kamsa Bar Kamsa. But Mr. Kamsa never shows up, not one time, except in the preamble where we talk about how it's his fault somehow that we lost Jerusalem. So that's where we have to talk about how can the poor guy, that guilt by association, he really wasn't even part of the story, and yet he's always, historically, the legacy, negativity is right there. So let's explore the source number two. So I'll just start off a little bit with the Gemara in Hebrew, because it's fun. And then we'll just go into the English when it becomes a little tiresome for everyone. So you'll give me a little heads up. Let's go in English. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the great sage Rabbi Yochanan, the author of the Jerusalem Talmud, says, and he asks the following question, "My dechsiv," what does it mean when it says the following in the Torah? "Ashrei Adam Happy is the person, mifachei tamid, that fears always, that's in a constant state of worry. Umakshe libo, but he who hardens his heart, yipol bira'ah, will always inexorably fall into evil. What is illustrative of this verse? Meaning, where do we see this in application? Stop for a second. So what does he say? What does it mean you're always worried? You're always worried about what might happen. Leadership is a very difficult mantle to hold. And the leaders of the Jews, that's what Rabbi Yochanan is talking about. It's very, very scary to have that responsibility on you, that you are making decisions for the masses. So if one is in a constant state of worry, okay, if I say this, if I allow this, what could be the permutations? So you're constantly processing and thinking and aware. So if you are in a constant state of worry, that's a good thing, because you'll be sensitive to the pratfalls that could happen if you're not careful. So where do we see that if you're not careful, you're going to fall into ra, into evil? So he's going to now cite three historical, horrible tragedies that all happened as a result, ostensibly, of a lack of foresight, a lack of worry about the future. And he's going to cite these three, okay? Here we go. Number two, line number two, not source two, but we're in source two, line two. It says, Akamtsa uvarkamtsa, as a result of the famous incident involving Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa, these two Jews who hated each other, Charuv Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, the temple was destroyed. Temple number two was destroyed by the Romans. Line number three, Atarnagola utarnagolsa, because of a rooster and a hen, Charuv Turamalka, the very beautiful, fertile northern settlement where thousands of Jews lived, called Turamalka in northern Israel, was destroyed because of a rooster and a hen. Ashaka derispak, and because of the shaft of a sedan, not a Cadillac, but rather a very famous chariot that belonged to the princess, daughter of one of the leaders of the Caesars. Because of a shaft of a sedan, a shaka derispak, Charuv Beitar, the famous city of Beitar, was killed along with tens of thousands of Jewish people. So three events happened, three events, over very, shall we say, inconsequential items. Kamtsa Bar Kamtsa, because of two Jewish people squabbling, temple in Jerusalem, destroyed. Because of a rooster and a hen, and I'll give you a little background in a moment. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? It's intriguing. A rooster and a hen? Turamalka, wiped out. Thousands were killed by the Romans, all killed by the Romans in every one of these scenarios. And Beitar is a more famous story. You probably know about it. It's a story of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. And we'll discuss the three things. So, in the story of Kamtsa Bar Kamtsa, we're going to learn about what happened. It had to do with a party and hurt feelings, and it became really a nightmare. But what about the other two that the Talmud, the Gemara is going to deal with them about two pages later, so they're not going to be included. They're out of the scope of tonight's class, but I think you should know what happened, right? It's germane. So what happened with the rooster and the hen? So they had like a little bit of a fertility rite that when a couple would get married, a young Jewish couple, in this place called Turim Malka, they would have a rooster and a hen, and they would make a blessing on the groom and on the bride that they should have lots of children, in the same way that the birds who were created before people were given the mitzvah, the command in the Torah. God said, Peru uruvu umilu et aretz. Birds, animals, be fruitful, multiply, have lots of children, and fill up the world. So they used to have a beautiful little rite, a weird rite, but whatever it was, that they had a rooster egg, which I guess represented the male, the groom, and the bride was represented by the hen. And they would have them there by the chuppah, you know, by the Jewish wedding ceremony. And they would give a blessing to the bride and groom. They had lots of children, lots of progeny. So it once happened that apparently there was a wedding going on. And they had a rooster and a hen waiting to go. They were designated to represent the young couple. And some Roman guys, some Roman hoodlums, hooligans, soldiers came by. And they were hungry. They wanted some Kentucky Fried Chicken. Okay. So they looked over there. Hey, there's a nice fat rooster and a hen. And they went. And they took the rooster in hand and had lunch. And of course, the Jewish people who were at the wedding went ballistic. They went crazy. And they started pelting the Roman soldiers, you know, with whatever. not a good thing, because when the heads of the Roman soldiers heard that their guys were attacked by this mob of enraged Jewish wedding goers, it had a really bad response, and everybody in Tarmac was killed as a result. So a hen and a rooster, boom, destruction. Crazy, right? It's a crazy story. All right, what happened with Betar about the, I know you're intrigued, but the broken shaft of a Cadillac sedan. So apparently, princess, beautiful princess, Roman girl, was being escorted in a sedan. She was in this beautiful, you know, fully escorted. I'm sure they had soldiers and everybody else. And unfortunately, she had a flat tire. So she couldn't call Canaan Automobile Association to come help her. I guess they wouldn't come to that part of Betar. So she looked up, and there were some beautiful trees. Now, unbeknownst to the Romans, these were special trees. There were cedar trees and pine trees. And again, there was a big custom in that part of the world, in Betar, among the Jews. Every time a Jewish boy was born, they would plant an Eitz Erez. A beautiful cedar tree would be representative of that boy. And every time a beautiful little girl, like an Ariel, was born, they would plant a pine tree. And when the young man and young woman became of age to get married, so they would cut down either the pine tree, if it was the girl getting married, or the cedar tree, if it was the young man getting married, and they would build the chuppah, the canopy, out of that tree that had been planted when they were born. So it's a beautiful custom, right? It was in Betar. Gorgeous custom. Again, having to do with, you know, getting married. Nice custom. So these Roman officers didn't know anything about the Jewish custom of Betar, just like you didn't know anything about it until the Talmud told us. And when they had a broken shaft on the fender of the Cadillac belonging to the princess, they unwittingly cut down one of the designated cedar trees. And again, the citizens of Betar were not happy campers. They pelted the Romans, including the girl got, you know, oranges and tomatoes thrown at her. And when she reported back to Dad this insult to the throne, Dad did not respond well, and Betar were just wiped out, men, women, children. Now, both of these events are crazy on many levels, right? I mean, they defy logic. We'll come back to them at the end of tonight. But just plant in your brain how inconsequential these events are. And yet, they were like minor holocausts for the people. Now, interestingly, the guys in our story, the third story, Kamsa Bar Kamsa, which is the focus of the next 15 minutes of tonight's class, the names Kamsa means an insect. So we don't even know if these are really their name. Could be, but if they are, it's like, a bug. It's like an inconsequential item. A guy named Kamsa, a bug, and a Bar Kamsa. He's not even a bug. He's just a Ben Kamsa, because a bar, like a bar mitzvah, means a son of a bug. So you have a bug and a son of a bug. So it's almost like the Talmud is always making fun and saying, you got a rooster and a hen, which killed everybody out in Torah Malka. You got a Cadillac sedan, a Shaka de Rispach, and that killed everybody in Beitar. And you got a bug and a son of a bug who couldn't get along, and Jerusalem was lost. So it's very interesting, right? The Talmud is clearly telling us something profound that we're going to have to readdress at the end of tonight. Okay, that'll be the takeaway later. All right. Number 4, line 4. So let's get back to the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. Okay? The two Jews who hated each other. It says, Akamsa Uvar Kamsa, Charuv Yerushalayim. So you said earlier that as a result of the incident involving the Jews, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. Well, what's the rest of the story? Give us the details, please. Gemara says, thank you for asking. A certain man, a very wealthy Jew in Israel, had a friend named Kamsa, and an enemy named Bar Kamsa. So again, the Jew, the rich Jew, had a Hatfield and a McCoy. There was a guy named Kamsa who was his best pal and bosom buddy, like Barney and Fred, right, in the Flintstones. And then he had the enemy, the dark side, the Darth Vader, which was Bar Kamsa. Rich guy. So rich guy is making the most lavish meal, a suda, meal to end all meals. He's going to have gold, silver. He's going to invite all the dignitaries, the rabbis, the politicians. Anyone who's anyone, everyone there who's important in Jerusalem is invited to this. We don't know the wealthy man's identity. But we do know that he loved Kamsa and he hated Bar Kamsa. So he goes to his servant, his trusted servant, Alfred. Right? Isn't every great servant named Alfred? Or is that just in Batman lore? I'm not sure. So he says, Alfred, The man once made a banquet, it says, Avad Sutaso, Amar Lei Lishame. So he said to his servant Alfred, Zeal, he said, go, Isile Kamsa, go bring me my best pal, Kamsa. I have a beautiful front row seat for him at my lavish meal, and I want him to feel the honor that I want to bestow upon Kamsa. So Alfred was a little sedate, was a little confused, as you're going to see. So the poor guy goes, and he, for some reason, got mixed up who he should invite. So instead of inviting Kamsa, it says the servant went and mistakenly brought Bar Kamsa to the meal. Now stop for a second. Now, at the point where Bar Kamsa is invited, you think, well, why would he go? I mean, he knows the disdain that the rich man feels towards him. So why would he even go? So some say that maybe he felt, oh my gosh, you know, I know that he hates my guts. But this must be some type of rapprochement. He wants to make up for the wrongs of the past. So if he is not, if he is not above, you know, inviting me, and he knows his antipathy towards me, it must be that maybe he wants to make up to me, whatever, so I'm going to go. So Bar Kamsa decides to come. He doesn't realize it's a mistake. So he comes into the meal, and the host is not there. So it's lavish. Everyone's there. The paparazzi are taking pictures as they all make their entrances, and, you know, maybe that broken Cadillac was outside, right, with the fender, who knows, right? They're all there, and they're taking the pictures. You can see it's a Waldorf. Donald Trump was probably there with his family, you know. And they're all there, and they're coming in from outside, and everyone's making entrance. So Bar Kamsa makes his entrance, and he comes in, announcing Bar Kamsa. Everyone's probably going like, what? Because people probably knew that Bar Kamsa was like persona non grata in a major way. So the people are probably thinking, oh my gosh, what in the world is that guy doing here? But he comes, he sits down, and then the host comes in. Oh my gosh, not good. So the end of line 7. When the host found Bar Kamsa sitting there, it says, Asa, Ashkeche Dahava Yasi. He saw Bar Kamsa sitting there with a big smile on his face, very self-important smile on his face, right? The host is not happy. So turn the page. Line 8. He, the host, said to him, and he's actually talking to himself in a very bizarre way. He says, Nichti, he says, wait a minute, look here. And he's not even talking like to Bar Kamsa. He started talking about him, and he's there. He's thinking to himself, that man, meaning you, you are the enemy of that man, me. Aren't you my most hated, contemptible villain in the world? What in the world are you doing here? Now, line 9, what do you want here? What are you, out of your mind to insinuate yourself into my party? Get up and get your carcass out of my domain, please. Now, obviously, at the moment where Bar Kamsa sees the reaction of the host, he realizes, oh my gosh, it was a mistake. I was obviously invited, not purposefully, not to make a rapprochement. Nothing has changed, but I'm here. So he quietly whispers to the host, Could you please not embarrass me publicly? I understand. Errors were made. I was mistakenly here, but I'm here. So please, the paparazzi here, everyone is here. The Roman, everyone's here. I understand, but could you let me stay, please? Don't embarrass me. So he says, Bar Kamsa said to the host, line 9, look, since I'm already here, Hayil v'asoy shvaket, let me stay. And not only if you let me stay, it'll be good for you, because I will pay you for whatever I eat and drink. I won't take a penny from you. I'll pay for whatever I eat and drink tonight. Just don't shame me. The host said to him, no, get up. Bar Kamsa said to him, oh, okay. Let me pay you half the cost of the entirety of the banquet, but just don't throw me out. Host said, no. Bar Kamsa said, okay. You drive a hard bargain. I will pay for the entire banquet. Just don't throw me out publicly, please. The host said to him, no. Then the host went to Nunzio and Guido. He said, get this guy out of here now. And they picked up Kamsa, and he picked him up by his hand, stood him up, and he just threw him unceremoniously out onto the sidewalk, right in front of all the cameras. And you can imagine the disgrace to Bar Kamsa. So Bar Kamsa, sitting there on his backside, gets up, dusts himself off. He is embarrassed beyond words. Now, let's stop for a second. So, many rabbis say, well, this is baseless hatred. So, I will in the future explain that there is a way to talk about baseless hatred. But my own Rebbe, my teacher, Rabbi Weinberg, says like this. He says, look, the reaction of Bar Kamsa to being thrown out of the party is so disproportionate to what was done to him. And it's illogical, as you'll see in a second, on a very, very fundamental level. So that if there was hatred between the host and Bar Kamsa, it was very warranted and it was deserved. And it wasn't nice, it wasn't pretty. But as you're going to see, Bar Kamsa was a detestable piece of human debris. He was horrific. So listen to what he does. He gets up off the sidewalk, okay, line number 14. And he said, well, since the rabbis were sitting there at the banquet and did not rebuke the host, did not stand up for me and take my side and say, don't embarrass Bar Kamsa, this shows why not saying anything that they must have agreed with his public shaming of me. Huh. It was those. In other words, he's not even angry, really, at the host, because that was, like, expected, right? Because they're at loggerheads. But he immediately blames the rabbis. Now, everybody's at the party, right? The rabbis weren't doing anything. They were there. Now, my Rebbe points out humorously, probably the reason that the rabbis didn't stand up for him is because the guy was the most horrific individual, which was a mitzvah, probably, to hate him because of how horrible a person he is. So the rabbis did not interject because he really was, as you'll see, a Jewish Hitler. He was a horrible person, so why would they stand up for him? So, but immediately, he goes after the rabbis. That, unquestionably, is a form of hatred. In other words, the hatred is not necessarily from the good guys to Bar Kamsa. It's Bar Kamsa's irrational reaction and the blame that he right away throws to the rabbis. Everybody else is there, not even the host who actually subjected him to the humiliation. That he doesn't feel is he's been wronged, right? He doesn't say, well, I'm going to kill the host. I'm going to get the rabbis for this. So that is way, way, way off, as they say, the reservation. Okay? Let's go back. So what does he say? Listen to this. Line 15. Listen to what this Bar Kamsa character says. So as a result of the rabbi sitting there and doing nothing in my defense, I will go, says Bar Kamsa, and spread slander. I will defame the rabbis in the royal palace of Caesar. Because I, Bar Kamsa, happen to be the one Jewish guy who has a really nice relationship with the king of the Romans. I can get these guys killed for what they did not do tonight. Now, nice guy, right? So he's embarrassed. And his response is, let's exterminate the Jews, even though he's a Jew. I want to kill the Jews. So again, let's go on. It's a great story, isn't it? It's a crazy story, but it's wow. Okay, let's go on. So what did he do? Line 16. Bar Kamsa went, and he said to Caesar, he did not say, et tu, Brute? He should have warned him if it wasn't. We don't know which Caesar. Caesar, by the way, could be a title of the local the one who, like, basically led the troops locally in Israel, meaning we know Titus eventually became the emperor, but, you know, there were underlings that were appointed by the big guy in Rome. So it doesn't necessarily mean it was the Caesar, although in this context, as you'll see, it could be the real Caesar. We're not sure. Okay, but anyways, he went to his friend, the Caesar, the ruler, and he said, you know, the Jews are rebelling against you. Now, he's a Jew. He says, those Jews, you have treaties with them, you trust them. don't trust them. They're rebelling. Now, Caesar's not an idiot. He probably knew that Bar Kamsa had an axe to grind with the Jews. And he doesn't just take his word for it. So he says, well, who says so? I'm supposed to take your word for it? Prove it. Oh, says Bar Kamsa. He has a plan. He's a nefarious character. All bad guys have good plans, right? He has a very diabolically clever plan. He says, okay, you don't want my word for it? I'll prove it to you. So Bar Kamsa said to Caesar, line 17, send the Jews an offering, an animal, a korban, a would-be sacrifice, and you see whether they will offer it in their holy temple. If they respect you and love you, they'll bring your animal to their god. If they will not bring your animal, then that's a sign of disrespect. And I'm right that they're rebelling. They have hearts that are hardened towards you, Caesar, and to the Romans, and you should get rid of them. So what does he do? And this is where the plan gets downright diabolical. So Caesar is not trying to trick anyone. It's a legitimate test. So he sends the finest calf that he can find, an Agla Talasa, beautiful, fattened calf. But he sends it, unfortunately, with Bar Kamsa. So that Bar Kamsa takes the calf and he transports it to Jerusalem on behalf of Caesar. While on the way to Jerusalem, secretly, Bar Kamsa takes his little Swiss army knife out of his pocket when Caesar's guards are not looking. And he makes a tiny little blemish. Some say it's on its upper lip of the animal. Some say it's on the white of the eye, like the cornea, the retina area of the eye. But in a place, line 20, where the Jewish people, we will count it as a mum, as a blemish, which prohibits that animal being brought on the holy altar at the Mizbeah, because it's a mum. But the non-Jewish people, for Caesar's point of view, it's not considered to be a blemish. Therefore, Caesar won't understand. No one will be able to see the type of mum. It's so small and so inconsequential that to the Kohanim, when the priest will analyze the animal to say, no, it's a mum, we can't bring it. Sorry. Caesar, though, would not accept this as a reason not to bring it. In other words, in Caesar's mind, this is still the perfect offering. And if you're not bringing it, it's because you're rebelling. Correct? So Bar Kamsa is a really, really sneaky guy. I mean, he's a bad person. And he figured this all out on his own. So he makes the mum, the blemish, and he brings the animal. So the Jewish people, the Kohanim, take the animal as a gift from Caesar, and they're ready to bring it. Because why not? But when, listen to what they did, when they look it over, they discover it has a mum, this blemish either on the lip or the eye. Even so, the rabbis got together and said, well, we're in a really bad situation. Because Caesar will not recognize our inability to bring his gift. He'll take it the wrong way, which, of course, was Bar Kamsa's intent all along. So the rabbi said, you know what? Let's bring it anyways, with or without the mum, because of Shalom Malchut. We need peaceful relations with the Roman government, because you know what? If Caesar gets the wrong idea, we could be in major trouble. So even though it's not really a korban, a sacrifice that should be brought, but because of pikuach nefesh, to save the lives potentially of Jews who could be killed, we're going to bring it one time and one time only. We'll allow it. Everyone's agreed except one rabbi. Unfortunately, the rabbi who disagreed was the one they all looked to for the final say. His name is Rabbi Zechariah ben Ufkalus. So line 22 on the last page. Amar lehu Reb Zechariah ben Ufkalus. Rabbi Zechariah, the son of Ufkalus, said to the other rabbis, he said, whoa, 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 whoa. You're going to bring Caesar's animal so that people, Jewish people, will say, oh, it's okay to bring blemished animals, sacrifices that have mums, that it's okay to offer them on the altar. That's your plan? I forbid it. It's a bad plan. So then the rabbis got together, they huddled, and they came up with another plan. They said, okay, Reb Zechariah, we defer to you. You're the grand poobah. So if you won't allow us, for the sake of protection of Jewish life, to offer one time and one time only the animal, then we only have one possibility. The man, Bar Kamsa, cannot be allowed to bring back the report of our inability and unwillingness to offer the sacrifice. He can't tell Caesar. Because if he tells Caesar, it's over. So we have no choice then, but again, to have him killed, because he has slandered the Jewish people, and by telling what has happened to Caesar, he's going to kill us all. Again, it's an issue of saving Jewish lives. We have to have him put to death. Reb Zechariah, what do you say? Oh no, he says, you can't kill Bar Kamsa, right? Number 23. The rabbis then proposed to kill Bar Kamsa so that he would not go and tell Caesar that his offer had been refused, right? Reb Zechariah, line 24, said to the rabbis, but then people will say that one who makes a blemish on consecrated animals is something that is kodesh, is put to death for making a blemish?
The logic is so off.
Line 25. So Rabbi Yochanan, yeah, the one who opened our entire sugya, the whole episode, began with Rabbi Yochanan. If you remember, he said, what does the verse mean when it says, happy, joyous is the one who is always worried about what might happen. And if you harden your heart, you're going to fall into evil. He says, the meekness of Rav Zechariah ben Ufkalus in refusing to have Bar Kamsa put to death or allowing the animal with the blemish to be brought for Caesar, because of this, It destroyed our temple. I mean, he's responsible for destroying our temple, burning down our Heichal, another name for the area of the temple, and having us exiled from our land. Stop for a second. Let's step back. So Rabbi Yochanan said, what is illustrative of a person who's scared of the future being happy, but one who is hardened in their heart towards what could be, you know, action, inaction, that person's going to commit evil? It seems to be that this Rabbi Zachariah did exactly what Rabbi Yochanan said he should be doing. He's worried. He's worried. He's wringing his hands. He's saying, well, wait a minute. If we allow the animal, then people might get the wrong impression that it's okay to bring consecrated animals that have blemishes. That's not good. People will get the wrong idea of the halachas, of the laws of how you bring sacrifices. But he's wringing his hands, you can hear, right? But if you kill Reb Bar Kamsa, people will think you get a death penalty just for making a little blemish on an animal. Where normally you get lashes, you don't get the death penalty. People will have the wrong impression. So it seems like the hand-wringing of Rav Zachariah, like that he's refused to take action, seems to be, on the surface anyway, exactly what Rabbi Yochanan introduced us with, which is that happy is the one who is always looking and worried about the future. He's worried. What will people say?
See, happy here, is the person.
But here's the thing. What did the verse say? It says, happy is the person who is mefachet tamid, who is always worried, but it really means continuously worried. So Reb Zachariah, the rabbi who refused to act, was worried a lot, very worried, what will people say? But he was only worried up to a point. In other words, his worry was either what will people say about animals and the rules of animals being brought as sacrifices? Or what will people say about a person who desecrated a sacrifice? But Reb Zachariah wasn't worried enough. He put an artificial limitation on his vision. What should his response have been? Reb Zachariah, I hear you. I understand that people will get the wrong impression if you allow the animal, or the wrong impression about the law if you kill Bar Kamsa for making the blemish. But just stand back for a second. If you don't allow the animal to be brought one time, or if you do not alternatively kill Bar Kamsa, guess what, Reb Zachariah? The whole worry that you have about what will people say will be a moot point, because there will not be a temple ever. It'll be blown up by the Romans, and it'll be inconsequential what people will say, because there'll never be sacrifices. Sacrifices will go away. People don't even know the rules of sacrifices anymore. It will go away. So you're worried about what will people say, but you're not worried enough, because by inaction, you're destroying the temple. In other words, who cares about the laws of sacrifice if there's no place to bring a sacrifice? Right? So that's what Rabbi Yochanan was saying. It's not that you have to be nervous and hand-wringing. That's a start. But you have to keep looking. What could be? What could be? What could be? So he was worried, but then his worry ended with one predetermined supposition. The temple in Jerusalem will always exist. Why will it always exist? Why, Rabbi Zachariah? If you don't act against Bar Kamsa one way or another, the temple will not exist. So in other words, his worry only extended to the laws of sacrifices. He should have been worried longer term. Inaction means there won't be laws of sacrifices to worry about, Rabbi Zachariah, because there'll be no temple anymore if you do nothing. Let's look at the last source, number three. Rabbi Yochanan, the son of Zakkai, not the same Rabbi Yochanan, by the way, from our Talmud, this is an earlier Rabbi Yochanan. He had five primary students, and mentions their names, and he said to them, this is the end of line three. He, Rabbi Yochanan, said to the students, go out and see what is a good way to which a person should cleave. Rabbi Shimon, one of his students, said, Haro'ah et hanolad, one who considers consequences. This is in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers. This is exactly what Rav Zachariah could not bring himself to see, which is exactly what the other Rabbi Yochanan was trying to bring about. You need to always be looking ahead. You can't tamid. Stop your worry artificially. You need to keep looking. Now, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow at the JCCs, but if you're there, you have to forgive me, but it's so timely, okay? Think about this. Our own government in America is egregiously transgressing what Rabbi Yochanan just told us not to transgress. They're looking, they're saying, well, but artificially, I'm only worried if there's a nuclear bomb, but if it's 10 years down the road and it's going to have complete sanction of the world, that already I don't worry about. That's 10 years. Really? So you're worried now, but you're not worried how the world's going to live with a nuclear Iran and Hezbollah, God forbid, or Hamas having a nuclear weapon. That doesn't concern you. It's only trying to get a deal now. So you're worried, right? Great, bravo, you're worried. You're not worried enough, though. You're Rabbi Zacharia. You're worried about, let's get the job so they can't... Okay, great, that's a start. But if you do nothing, you're going to have a bar kamsa come with a nuclear bomb and blow up Jerusalem. I don't understand. I mean, how could this be more timely? It could not be more timely than this whole idea. Haroe et anola. We need, and that's what Israel gets... But apparently the nations of the world who signed on today at the UN, who approved this unanimously, don't get this. That 10 years is a drop in the bucket. That, in other words, if the Iranians, in a worst-case scenario, keep the letter of their agreement, nothing will happen for 10 years. And then in 10 years, there's no constraint on their ability to build a bomb. They have the complete approval of the Western world and the Eastern world and every part of the world. So 10 years? Great. 10 years, what's going to be with Israel at that point? So that's haroet anolad. Ashrei, happy is the person who thinks it through and who doesn't look at just short-term worry about details. That's important too. That's a start. But you cannot artificially stop your worry and congratulate yourself and have big smiles for a photo op and say, we got the job done because we booted it down the road.
Like John Kerry.
Yeah. So Rav Zacharia, I'm sorry to say that you were joined in infamy, according to the Gemara, by a lot of very famous people in our world today. The good news, the takeaway, is that Israel's going to be okay, Baruch Hashem, because that's God's promise to the world. Bereshis bara. God created this world for this nation called Reshit, the first of his people, Jewish people, Yisrael Nikra, Reshit for Israel, which is called the first of his people. The world can't exist without our people. We're going to get through this. We're no longer subject to the whims of the world like we were in the 40s. We have our own defenses. We have our own power, Baruch Hashem. And God willing, you know, things will change in the next 10 years and the will of the world will be with us and whatever we have to do. But it just might be a whole lot more difficult to do 10 years down the road. Should be God's blessing upon the Jewish people and haroe et anola. Smarter people will start to see the end game and start to think a little bit farther ahead.